Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from November 3rd, 1997.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be in your time zone. And welcome to another edition of the best in live, in fact, the largest in live overnight talk radio in North America and beyond. This is Coast to Coast AM. Emanating, radiating from the west toward the Tahitian and Hawaiian island chains, racing eastward all the way to the Caribbean, the U.S. Virgin Islands. Good morning in St. Thomas and elsewhere. South into South America, north all the way to the pole and worldwide on the internet. Yes, Coast to Coast AM. All right, we are going to begin the week, and I'll give you more of an update on the week as the night rolls on. But we're going to begin the week with an update from Bob Guccione. Bob Guccione is the publisher of Penthouse Magazine. His wife, Kathy, passed away a short time ago since the last interview. And we're going to find out about that and where hydrazine sulfate. And I guess I got about a million faxes and emails after that last program. So please, if you are concerned with regard to hydrazine sulfate, it's a potential for treating cancer. Stay tuned, because Bob Guccione certainly will have the latest for you, and on his loss, of course. Following Bob, in the next hour, we're going to have Steve Bassett on. Steve is the only UFO registered lobbyist in Washington, D.C. And I'm going to tell you right up front, he's going to be talking about some things that he probably shouldn't be talking about yet. So you're going to have to listen very closely and, in a sense, read between the lines. So in a moment, Bob Guccione, and then Steve Bassett next hour, beginning next hour. We'll get to all of that. We'll begin all of that in a moment. All right, now, Bob Guccione is the publisher of Penthouse Magazine. And he is also an advocate of hydrazine sulfate. Those of you who heard the previous show with Bob, that was 2 or 3 months ago at least, will recall what he had to say at that point. Then we had Kathy on the show as well, his wife. And it seems appropriate at this point to have Bob back on. So here once again is Bob Guccione. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Al.
Bob, first of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. How are you doing?
Well, I'm managing. It's not easy, but things are a bit better now than they were.
It's unimaginable to me, Bob. To lose your mate, I guess half the people on the planet nearly experience that, and I'm sure it doesn't make it a bit easier. Everybody should know, Bob, the manner of your wife's passing because of her advocacy of hydrazine sulfate. A lot of people said mentally when they heard she passed away, oh, it didn't help. I'm sure that's what they said in their mind. You know, her passing made the news, but they didn't say much more than that. I think I saw something that said complications in surgery. But,
right.
You know, it didn't go beyond that.
That's right. She had developed where she had once had a tumor, and the tumor was neutralized by hydrazine. It eventually became scar tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very unfortunate that the scar mass was right in her duodenum, that is the the place where the stomach meets the intestine.
Yes.
And she was unable to process food in her stomach, so she had to be fed intravenously. And obviously, in those circumstances, an operation became necessary. And it was the operation and the fact that her platelets were very, very low at the time, and they couldn't stop her bleeding. She went into a coma and died as a result of the hemorrhage. So it was indirectly related to the cancer, but it had little or nothing to do with the efficacy of hydrazine sulfate. It was because of hydrazine and because of Kathy's choice of that therapy that she did live another 2.5 years after she was given 3 to 6 weeks by her doctors. So it did give us that time together, and it was a good time for her. It wasn't like people on traditional therapies like chemotherapy, for example, where you lose your hair and you have terrible, terrible problems with digestion. And
the quality of life is not good.
It's terrible. And then again, although chemo does often knock out the tumors, they invariably come back. And when they come back, they're more virulent than ever. And Kathy elected not to take that route. She decided on hydrazine sulfate. And everything went swimmingly well until they discovered that mess, until she found that she couldn't swallow. And that was it. There was just nothing more that we could do.
It's very important that people understand that it was not, A, it was certainly not hydrazine sulfate that killed her.
No, B,
hydrazine sulfate did indeed kill the tumors.
You know what? If the last time we spoke, I think it was in September, I believe.
Sounds about right.
Around the time that our September issue came out with the story of Kathy's.
That's correct.
Fight with cancer and the fact that she was taking hydrazine sulfate. We complained in that article that the National Cancer Institute had deliberately sabotaged the human trials it had conducted on behalf of hydrazine sulfate when we knew that the National Cancer Institute did not want to see hydrazine sulfate on the market. And when they conducted their trials, there was something like 600 people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the trials over from UCLA. They were begun by the university, UCLA. And they did a number of things that were indifferent to the protocol with hydrazine, the protocol being that simply that you cannot take alcohol or barbiturates or antidepressants, etc., with hydrazine sulfate because it tends to neutralize the drug and destroy its efficacy.
So the tests then were tainted?
Not only tainted, they were deliberately sabotaged, and we maintained that in the article. And when we learned of it, we went straight to the... We got no response from the NCI, of course. We went straight to the GAO. The GAO is the Government Accounting Office.
Right.
And for those members of the public that don't understand what the GAO is, it is an extension of Congress, and it is empowered to monitor and investigate the activities of other government agencies. So we
basically, they're an auditing agency. In other words, they follow the money.
Right. And they do conduct serious, in-depth investigations of wrongdoing on the part of other government departments.
Sure.
So we had to make a prima facie case to them, demonstrating that the NCI deliberately sabotaged those trials, or they would not have acted, and they did act on it. They accepted what we said. They did an in-depth investigation, which lasted about 9 months, and gathered together a whole lot of stuff supporting what we had said. And I know this because from time to time we would speak to the point people at the GAO who were doing the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, the GAO suddenly recants its position and publishes something that says, publishes an article which says, or rather their report, which said in effect that despite suggestions to the contrary, the National Cancer Institute's hydrazine sulfate trials were not flawed. Well, that was absolutely the opposite of what they were telling us they discovered when they were investigating the NCI and looking at their work papers and so on. Meantime, So we did an article attacking both the GAO and the NCI, saying that they had colluded between them and so on. And we took full-page ads in the Washington Post and the New York Times and other newspapers around the country, telling people that the article that would support this contention was in that month's issue of Penthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the article was read by a fellow called Jeffrey Robbins. Jeffrey Robbins, he saw the ad in the Washington Post, bought the magazine, read the article, and he is the chief counsel to the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations. He has a higher investigative level and position in government than the GAO itself. He has the power to subpoena anybody he wants in the United States, including the president. In fact, he is the guy who is responsible for the present investigation of the Democratic fundraising problem. That's the other thing he's doing.
Okay.
And he took this case to heart. He read it, read the article, called Kathy directly. Kathy told him her story, put him on to Joe Gold, the doctor who created, the research scientist who created this therapeutic use for hydrazine sulfate. And also we put him on to our investigative reporter and other investigators in the Washington area. Jeffrey Robbins conducted his own investigation and recently wrote a 7-page letter to the GAO telling them that the report that they had done was absurd. In fact, his own words were plainly absurd and extremely misleading. He said that totally vindicated Penthouse. He said that we were absolutely right, that they did in fact collude with the NCI. On his discovery process, he turned up.
On what date did he come back with this, Bob?
This letter was written on October the 15th.
Okay. On what day did Kathy pass away?
September the 19th.
Okay. Well, it's too bad she wasn't there to see that letter.
Yes, I mean, this would have meant so much to her, because we've been screaming about this. We've been publishing articles on hydrazine sulfate. We've been talking about the NCI and its terrible conduct, the conduct of those human trials. And incidentally, most of those people died because they weren't, you know, they weren't given the proper protocol. They were, I think it was something like 96% of them were given alcohol and barbiturates deliberately, mind you, deliberately. Now, these are our contentions. This is now the conclusion reached by Jeffrey Robbins.
I mean, you, when you think about it, Bob, what you're saying here implies incredible collusion, from the National Cancer Institute to the GAO?
Right.
Believe
that? I mean, it's such an incredible thing. When you tell this to people, they say, you mean to tell me that our government would do something that would endanger the lives of millions of people? And I said, absolutely, but it's not the government. You know, the government is an amorphous structure run by individual people, many of whom have their own private agenda. So what has happened here is not the government that's colluding with another government department. It is individuals colluding with other individuals for their own purposes, their own end.
Well, if you look back, Bob, if you look back, for example, at the Tuskegee experiments,
exactly.
Horrible as they were, there was at least an arguable motivation, scientific motivation, for why they did what they did. Now, in the case of the hydrazine sulfate tests, the only conclusion, unless you can come up with some other, that I can imagine, is that they don't want a cheap, easy cure for cancer, and it's money.
Precisely. Let me just give you a completely hypothetical scenario, but one that could apply. Just imagine somebody, one of the individuals involved with these huge pharmaceutical companies that spend hundreds of millions of dollars to get pills through the FDA.
Right.
To get a pill on the market could cost between $400 and $600 million.
Wow.
Now, one of these guys could say to somebody, to a buddy of his at the NCI, look, we spent a lot of money getting, you know, getting this on a market, getting our chemotherapy on the market and so on. And there are billions and billions of dollars involved in chemotherapy and the other traditional cancer cures.
Oh, yes.
We don't want to see a pill that costs $3 a week get on the market, which is going to, you know, cancel out or neutralize what we're trying to do. So he'd say to his buddy at the NCI, look, you're going to retire in 5 years. I've got a home in Palm Beach. There's a car in a garage. Why don't you go down here with your wife and spend the rest of your time there on me? Now, this is very, very possible. You're talking to a civil servant, a guy who may make $60,000 a year at the top end, and suddenly he's faced with the possibility of retirement with a beautiful home in Palm Beach, a car in his garage, a boat. This is nothing to the pharmaceutical industrial establishment in this country.
Still, though, when you think about it, maybe I'm just overestimating the human soul, Bob, but when you think about it, that same story would have to be bought by at least several people. And when you balance, you know, a nice house and a nice car and a few years in retirement before you die, and in an eternity in hell, if there happens to be one, that wouldn't be an easy choice to make.
Right. Yeah, quite right.
So at least several people had to buy off on that same
argument. They do, unfortunately. Now, like I said, that's just a hypothetical scenario. It may be something like that, or it may not be. But nonetheless, there's individuals involved. It isn't the government itself. It's the guys who run the government. It's key people, key civil servants that can make judgments like that, can make decisions like that, that literally will affect hundreds of thousands of lives in this country. Now, since we've been publishing stories on hydrazine sulfate, we have had thousands upon thousands of doctors get in touch with us and get in touch with Joe Gold. And they have put patients on hydrazine sulfate. We've had results back, which were terrific. A lot of lives have been saved directly as a result of this $3 a week pill.
Are you keeping a good database now on exactly
pretty much,
those results?
Pretty much, and we're supplying it to, we're supplying Jeffrey Robbins and his people with a lot of this information. He's been talking directly to doctors that have used this and are thrilled with it, with the way it works, thrilled with the success that their patients have had. And, you know, when you think hydrazine sulfate will never make any money for anybody, I mean, Joe Gold, the guy behind it, has been working on it for years and years and years, will never make 10 cents on it, nor will anybody else, nor will the manufacturers, because it's a generic drug and it's made in vast quantities because its other use, as I mentioned in the past, is that it's a component in rocket fuel as well as being an industrial cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
But it has been part of the pharmacology now for 55 years. It has recognized medicinal uses. And it was Gold who found out that it had great effect on cancer patients. Almost all cancers respond to it immediately.
All right, Bob, hold tight on that point. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back to you. My guest is Bob Guccione, publisher of Penthouse Magazine. His wife, Kathy, passed away recently, September 19th. But the story of hydrazine sulfate indeed goes on. Bob will be right back. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from November 3rd, 1997.
Bob Guccione, publisher, Penthouse Magazine, is here. He recently lost his wife, Kathy, but the battle for hydrazine sulfate continues. We'll tell you more about it in a moment. Bob Guccione, Bob, you said it virtually attacks and eliminates every sort of a cancerous tumor. Is that accurate, or can you expand exactly what it affects?
No, it does. There are some cancers and some certain cancers at certain stages of development which are not, and again, in certain people that are not affected by hydrazine. Hydrazine works on about 67% of terminal patients. It works on a far greater percentage of people if they catch it early enough. But when cases are considered terminal, that is to say, when a doctor tells the patient there's nothing further we can do for you,
right,
there's nothing further in medicine, it's at that point that the efficacy of hydrazine sulfate is rated at about 67%.
That's
astounding. Those are the statistics found by Gold and other researchers in this country, and they are precisely the same as the statistics arrived at in the Russian trials, which were conducted over 14 years with human patients.
Are there any statistics at all, Bob, for people who begin using it at a stage prior to a fatal diagnosis?
Stage 4, yes. It's very, very effective. And I don't know the exact number, but the statistics are very high. If you catch it early enough, what it does, let me explain a little point. Actually, it was developed for cachexia. Cachexia is that late stage of cancer when the tumors have begun to cannibalize the body itself.
Mm-hmm.
When you can no longer eat, you no longer have any appetite, you start wasting away, and the tumors begin to feed themselves by actually cannibalizing the body, the host body. It's at that stage that the cancer patient becomes very, very ill, has no longer any real control, his immune system is zonked out completely, and anything that attacks him, any bug that attacks him, will kill him. And people don't actually die of cancer. They die of other things that develop during the cachexia stage.
It's kind of like AIDS, really.
It's like AIDS.
Opportunistic infections kill you.
Right, exactly. And this happens with a number of diseases. That's why hydrazine sulfate also has some applicability with AIDS patients. And that's being tested now. But what it does in the case of the cancer patients, it overcomes the cachexia. That's what it was designed to do, what Gold's therapy designed it to do.
How does it kill a tumor?
And it also has the effect of actually killing tumors. And I can't explain technically what happens. I'm sorry, Arthur.
So we don't.
I don't want to make a mistake, and I can't give you a technical explanation.
If Dr. Gold was here, would he be able to tell us
absolutely,
how
and
he would
tell you exactly? And I suggest you have him on the air because he's most interesting.
I should get a number to me. We'll have him on.
I will do that.
All right. Now, so you've got as of October 15th, New Hope on an investigation. What's going on there?
Well, I actually spoke to Robbins this afternoon. He called me up just like that. He calls from time to time and reports his progress. He is personally incensed by what has happened. And he said to me, he said, I'm outraged. I'm personally affronted by what I read and by what I saw and by the interviews I conducted. He had the GAO people there. One of the things, can you listen to this? If you can imagine, one of the officials of the GAO said, well, look, in the end, what's the difference whether our report was incorrect? Because nobody reads GAO reports. And Jeffrey says, I beg to differ with you, but many congressmen read and many people within the government rely on these GAO reports. That's why they exist. And one of the officials turns around and says, well, look, why doesn't Bob Guccione pay for the trials himself? Can you imagine that?
No.
And Jeffrey said, well, look, what are you talking about? This is what the NCI is supposed to do, and they're supposed to fund it with taxpayers' money. This is not something for an individual American to do. to come up with that kind of money to conduct these kind of trials. That's your job. That's the job of the NCI. And that's what you're doing with taxpayers' money. You spend billions of dollars, and where does it all go? They've gone through something like $400 billion in the so-called war against cancer. Where has the money gone? It's all gone into chemotherapy, and it's gone into these vast hospital repositories of the classical, all of the classical cancer treatments. Nothing new, nothing innovative, nothing alternative, nothing integrated. It's all chemotherapy, surgery, or radiation. And hospitals like Mount Sinai and Sloan Kettering, these are bastions, great bastions to chemotherapy. And they have hundreds of millions of dollars of plant and equipment installed to deal with cancer. They don't want to see a little penny ante treatment come along which puts all their stuff to shame for $3 a week.
All right.
They can't support that. They can't live with it.
Listen, Bob, the last time you were on, and then, of course, Kathy followed on, I was inundated. And I'm sure you can understand that that would occur. There are thousands of people listening right now who probably have some stage of cancer, many with a fatal diagnosis now. They're desperate. And even at the slight mention by a friend that they heard this thing on the radio with Bob Guccione about hydrazine sulfate, they're desperate. And they want information, and I refer them consistently to the September issue of Penthouse. Is there any other route now? I'm going to get the same thing this time, Bob. People who are desperate, what can we tell them?
Well, they can access our website, the Kathy Keaton Foundation, and the address is www.kathykeaton.com. K-E-E-T-O-N, all one word, kathykeaton-cancer.com. Or they can write to us directly. They can write to Kathy Keaton Foundation. That's at General Media, the offices of Penthouse. That's 277 Park Avenue, New York. And we will send them all the information. We've got a vast quantity of information, and we send it to anybody who gets in touch with us, free, of course. And it contains everything they need to know. It tells them whom their doctors can call, where they can get this, all the information, where they can actually get hydrazine sulfate, because it is available, it is being sold in this country. It's not being sold for cancer, you know, because the government won't allow that. But it can be bought, and it has other medicinal uses, so your doctor can prescribe it and you can get it. And we tell you where to get it.
And it is very important, not just that you get it and that your doctor prescribe it for you, but that that doctor understand the regimen under which you're going to take
right.
it.
All of that information would be made available to whomever gets in touch with us. They will learn the protocol. They'll be able to give the information to their doctors. Their doctors will have a place to call where they can get further information.
You're going to keep the fight going.
Oh, yes. And we're going to continue in our class action suit. We're going to bring that suit. And one of the people who's going to join our team of lawyers, believe it or not, is the chief investigator, the chief counsel for the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations, Mr. Jeffrey Robbins. He's very much on our team. He's being put together with the other lawyers now. And as soon as we've got the names of people who actually participated, or rather the families of people who participated in those NCI trials between 1989 and 1993, we will bring suit against, not against the government, because you can't sue the government, but you can sue individuals within the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, drags the government in, and it opens up discovery for you. And incidentally, another very interesting aspect of this, when we sent out a press release based on Jeffrey Robbins' letter to the GAO, we got a reply from someone who has been producing a medical newsletter for a number of years, and that this particular individual specializes in looking for corruption in government with respect to the medical establishment. And he said to us, he said, I've been following the hydrazine story for a number of years. I know all about it. I know what's going on. I believe that the government, that the NCI did sabotage those trials because they've done it before, and they've done it on a number of separate occasions, and I have personal documentation to prove that the NCI and other aspects, you know, other departments of the government have actually sabotaged trials dealing with drugs that would be used for AIDS patients as well, and other things. So there is a great, great deal of corruption in the medical establishment. And when one understands how big it is, you know, anything that's that big in terms of money, hundreds of billions of dollars go through this, go through the medical establishment every year. And realizing that, you can appreciate how corruption can grow. It's political, it's greed, it's economic. And don't forget, it's the giant pharmaceutical companies like the petrochemical industry that literally runs our country and runs probably the rest of the world.
It's just, it's almost unimaginable for me to,
isn't it?
It is, that somebody could consciously make these decisions. There must be some way that the pill was softened for them, because I can imagine one or two people caving in, perhaps, but the number of people that would have had to have mentally caved in must have been a very large number indeed. That's just unimaginable to me, but I guess it can be. I tend to overrate human beings, I suppose.
it's the most difficult thing for us to believe in this country of ours, which is still the freest and the most democratic nation on earth, and probably has the best form of government ever created by a society, to have such a disease within the government itself. As I say, it isn't the government. The government is ideal. It's the individuals. It's the people. That's where the corruption lies. You can't, you can never get that out. You know, there's always going to be someone who is tempted by something, who's in a position of power and a position to make decisions that affect the lives of thousands and millions of other people. And that's exactly what happened in this case. By keeping hydrazine sulfate off the market, by trying to bury it, by telling people that it's no good, by conducting trials that are deliberately sabotaged to show that the product doesn't work, doing that sort of thing has hurt and killed God knows how many tens of thousands of people, and will continue to do so. If people like Kathy were not fighting for it, Kathy and I and Joe Gold and Jeffrey Robbins and all the other people who were involved, if we weren't fighting to stop it, it would go on forever.
How much has to happen now before you can get new trials?
Well, we've just got to get... You see, it's very difficult to find the families of these patients because they don't know. You have to sign a confidentiality agreement. You have to sign a consent form, and someone's got to be lodged with your lawyer or your family doctor before you can get into one of these trials. And they will never disclose, and they're not, and by law, not required to disclose the identity of these people. So to find, we've had lots of people get in touch with us because we're running ads in all of our magazines, you know, saying that if you were part of the UCLA NCI trials between 89 and 93 for hydrazine sulfate, get in touch with us. We've had lots of people get in touch with us saying, well, my father was treated at that time or my mother was treated, but they died, and we don't know whether they were treated with hydrazine sulfate. We don't know whether it was the NCI trials or not. It's very difficult to ascertain that because most of the people that were actually involved are no longer here. They're dead.
The family...
We will find them, and one of the ways I think we're going to find them is through this Senate subcommittee on investigations. If we can't get it in the ordinary way, they'll go in the back door and come up with names. And as soon as we've got some people, we go to court.
Who do you have to get to get those names?
The NCI certainly would have them, and the individual doctors who were conducting the actual trials.
The master database, though, would be with NCI.
Would be with the NCI, yes.
And
or UCLA, and then UCLA can't do anything about it. They are not permitted to disclose any information.
Which would be the weakest link if you were going after trying to get hold of the list?
I think the NCI, because once we get discovery, you know, once we get our lawsuit off the ground, the NCI will have to cough up information. They'll have to disclose it. And I think that this fellow, Jeffrey Robbins, can probably accomplish that even before we get into discovery. He's already come up with so much stuff now, it's unimaginable. He can't even believe what he's found out. He says, I knew there was corruption. I've been investigating corruption in government all my career. He said, I was willing to believe what you said in the magazine. I was willing to believe that was so. But now that I see it with my own eyes, now that I've actually examined the documents, he said, I'm incensed.
One quick final item. Maybe there are a lot of people that can be helped out. You just lost your wife. I said earlier, it's unmanageable. I can't imagine losing my wife. How do you deal with that? Maybe it's individual, or maybe there's something you can say that
will help. It was incredibly difficult at the time. This was back in September. I still cannot look at her papers. I can't open one of her drawers. I haven't allowed the maids to touch anything. Everything is exactly the way she left it. I can't look at it yet. I can't begin to process her papers. I just can't do it. I break up. So that time has to pass before I'm able to deal with that. In the meantime, thanks to my daughter and some people who are close to me, they've been helping, and they've made it possible for me to carry on. Otherwise, I lost all my motivation. I didn't want to work. I didn't want to do anything.
So there is no answer. It's just time.
That's right. We were together for 32 years, and I don't know anybody who was ever closer than we were. We were extremely close. We were always together.
I suppose...
We were each other's best friend. I don't have any friends.
I suppose it's...
No one close.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest test in life, you know, for those who live. I think it is.
Yes, I'm sure you're right.
All right. How many families do you need before you can start moving?
I think we need one.
Just one?
Just one, yeah.
Are there any families out there, Bob, who would have the records, any sort of medical record documentation at all?
Everyone who's been in touch with us and said, we don't know whether we qualify, but this is what we remember and so on. We wrote back to them and said, go to your family doctor. Go to your family lawyer and see if there isn't a consent form lodged with them, because the patient, if it was your father or whoever it was, had to have signed a consent form. So that exists somewhere, and these people are looking for it. As soon as somebody finds something, we go to town.
All right. They can get hold of me, too. Just in case they can't get hold of you, they can get hold of me, and I can certainly pass it on.
Absolutely.
To you.
And I'm going to have Gold get in touch with you, because you really have to talk to this man.
I quite agree.
So much information.
I want the medical side of it, Bob. There's no question about it.
Can you imagine? There isn't a family in America. There isn't an individual in this country who doesn't have someone somewhere, either a member of his family or a spouse or someone very close to them, who suffers from cancer or who has died from cancer. Everybody has that. It's something that touches every single man, woman, and child in America, and in the world for that matter. One out of every four people are going to contract cancer. And God help us.
One out of every four people. One out of every four.
25% of every American will come down with cancer in one form or another.
All right. Well, Bob, I appreciate your being on again, and this is not the end of it. We'll have you back again as events warrant. All right?
Thank you very much, John.
Take care, Bob. That's Bob Guccione from Penthouse Magazine. And again, so sorry for his recent loss. He lost his wife. Can you imagine that? October 15th. Anyway, the story of hydrazine sulfate continues. In a moment coming up from Washington, D.C., Steve Bassett. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
When you first came my way, I
Square Network presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 3rd of November, 1997.
Good morning. Coming up in a moment, Steve Bassett. He is the only UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. That makes him a very, very important guy for us, anybody who cares about what's going on with the investigation into... Well, it's going to go into areas that you're just simply not going to believe. And we'll get into all of that in a moment. UFOs, Steve Bassett knows about UFOs. He knows about what might really be done to get to the bottom of this story. So he's the guy to talk to, and talk to him we shall in a moment. In 1995, Stephen Bassett decided to bring a 15-year background in business development and consulting and a degree, get this, in physics into the field of extraterrestrial phenomena research. He set up a consulting practice, Paradigm Research Group, in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area to provide support to other UFO researchers and activists in the form of lobbying, media liaison, funding proposals, and secondary research. In April of 96, he attended the press conference held in Washington, D.C. by Richard Hoagland and the Enterprise Mission on the Moon Mars Photographic Evidence. In April of this year, he attended the press and congressional briefings conducted in Washington, D.C. by Stephen Greer and C. SETI. In July, he assisted Robert and Cecilia Dean in launching Stargate International's 1997 petition for an open congressional hearing on modern UFO evidence. As a matter of fact, we have a copy of that petition on my website right now, along with a number of other things I'll tell you about. Currently, Mr. Bassett is working to bring the United States Congress formally into the process of disclosure and working with Operation Right to Know and other groups in that regard. He also assisted Frances Barwood, the city council woman in Phoenix, Arizona, in dealing with a rather aggressive attempt by her political opponents to discredit and punish her for speaking publicly and in council session on the lack of a proper investigation of the Phoenix UFO sighting in March of 97. Another ongoing project, publicizing the complex issues represented by the Area 51 environmental damage lawsuit, currently working its way through the court system on behalf of former Area 51 employees. This case is being pressed by Jonathan Turley of the Environmental Law Advocacy Center at George Washington University. Sometime in 1997, Mr. Bassett anticipates assisting Stargate International's Coalition for Honesty in Government in presenting 1 million-plus petition signatures calling for an open congressional hearing to representatives of the House and the Senate. And I have a late-breaking news story on Area 51 that I'm going to read to you in just one moment. From the Associated Press. Just before we go to Steve in Washington, I thought this appropriate to read from Daryl. Daryl says, Art, Bob Guccione may have had several lessons to offer all of us, and of course, one of them concerns hydrazine sulfate, but the other is about his love for his wife, which is reflected in the pain in his voice with every word he utters. If, in fact, there has been a suppression of information with regard to the effectiveness of this chemical, I would not want to be among those standing in the way of Bob Guccione's direction and dedication at this time. I'll second that. Good luck, Bob, and God bless Daryl. And I'll sure second that. I would not want to be anybody standing in his way on this issue myself. In a kind of a strange way, Steve Bassett may have some comments on this as the evening wears on. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Art. Nice to be here again.
Before we get going, I want to read you a late-breaking Associated Press story. It cleared the wire at 10:49 p.m. That would have been, no doubt, Eastern Time. That would have been Eastern Time, I believe, for Associated Press. Dateline Las Vegas. Let me read this. The continuing saga involving Area 51, a top-secret base northwest of Las Vegas, moves to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Wednesday, where the ruling of a federal judge will be challenged. The case involves former workers at the secret base who claim they were harmed by toxic substances that were disposed of at that site. Area 51, about 125 miles north of Las Vegas, was established by the CIA in the 1950s. Spy planes, stealth fighters, and other secret elements of America's military firepower reportedly have been tested at that location. The plaintiffs allege hazardous and toxic waste was burned at that facility throughout the 1980s while workers were denied protective clothing. They say the waste was placed in, get this, 55-gallon drums that were then dumped in open trenches covered with combustible material and set afire with the help of jet fuel. The plaintiffs charge that the exposure killed former sheet metal worker Thomas Kaza at age 73 and Robert Frost at age 57, both of whom left widows in Las Vegas. Others say the exposure damaged their skin. The plaintiffs are not asking for money, just that the truth come forth and the government be held accountable for criminal, underline that word, activity. And that is an Associated Press wire story that just cleared the wires. There you have it, Steve.
Well, I'm glad you got that, Art, and I'm glad the AP picked that up. I will have a great deal to say about the Area 51 case later in the show.
All right.
And I hope your listeners can hang with us on that. As a matter of fact, there is a tremendous amount to talk about this evening, and again, I hope your listeners can stay with us. But before I begin, I'd like to take just a moment to add to your condolences mine to Bob Guccione. Kathy Keaton was a wonderful, positive force of nature. And for some of your listeners who don't know this, imagine most of them do, in addition to publishing and editing the Longevity magazine, she, of course, was the editor-publisher of Omni for many, many, many years. And Omni magazine, during a very long dry stretch, before the documentaries were available on all the cable channels that we see now, and before all the movies that were made that are very content-specific to the
sure.
UFO research, and really almost any other mainstream exposure, Omni was the lone mainstream media that was each month popping away at the UFO issue,
that's right.
That section of the magazine, as well as other articles, and essentially kept the issues in the general public's eye for many, many years, and I hope the day will come when she will get the appropriate credit that she deserves for keeping hope alive during that period on this issue.
Well, dare I now open up this can of worms?
I wouldn't do that. Let's let that can of worms sit on the shelf, if it's okay, because
yeah,
there's a lot to talk about. Maybe we can revisit it a little bit later, but I just wanted to let some people know who may not realize that she had a very significant impact on the UFO research and the awareness in this country.
All right, then I will simply ask the audience then to park that fact in the back of their mind, and
yes.
Maybe we'll pry it from you later. Let me then read you one other thing that I'm sure you do want to talk about. Art, this is an email I just got. The Discovery Channel was to air a program called Inside Area 51 mm-hmm. on November 2nd, 1997. Mm-hmm. However, at the last minute, the show was pulled mm-hmm. and another put in its place. I called Discovery Communications in Bethesda, asked what happened, and I was told, yes, the show was pulled at the last minute. However, the person said they didn't have any reason why. Now, it may be nothing, it may be something, but it certainly is strange. The show is listed again on November 9th, but Discovery told my emailer that that show will not be aired either. Now, that's kind of strange. That's point one. Point two, they did air a show about the lights over Phoenix, which most people are regarding as very fair, and I didn't happen to catch it. I wasn't warned sufficiently ahead of time.
I did.
So tell us about that Discovery show.
Okay, it's a little ahead of things, but let me quickly jump in. First, let me say that as far as the yanking of the Area 51, which I noted, right, and I, of course, am aware of the case going into court on Wednesday, and I'm aware of Discovery's position here in Washington. I don't have much to say, though I'm sure that Dick Hoagland already has got at least 2 pages written up on there.
I'm sure he does.
Well, very quickly, we're kind of jumping ahead, but very quickly.
I know.
The show on the Phoenix Lights was impressive. It was, on many fronts, very exceptional. And it very much showed, in a stark fashion, just how far things have come. I won't bore you with details of other situations where some of the mainstream channels or networks have done things on some of these issues and hacked it up pretty badly. There are many, and we could recount them. But this one, obviously, I was most interested to see how it would go. And what I noted were several things. First of all, Francis Barwood came out absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
As a beginning launch for her run for the Secretary of State, she could not have asked for a better exposure to the general public. And let's keep in mind that there was a lot of basis for them to make fun of her or to attack her if they wanted. They did not do that. On the other hand, the esteemed governor of Arizona, recently indicted and convicted of some financial problems, they showed, which I had never seen, quite a bit from his joke press conference where he brought out one of his aides wearing a giant E.T. Costume, and frankly, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I saw that live on CNN.
The contrast between the two was absolutely vivid, and the show clearly went out of their way to show this. Now, that was point one. Point two, they gave a lot of excellent exposure to Village Labs and Jim Dellatoso, which I think is going to help them a great deal. They were very fair in the looking at the various approaches of analysis that were done on those lights, bringing in the National Guard information, the other lights that were used as a counterpoint, an actual film of some flares being done. And when they were done, they really did not come to a final conclusion. They clearly left it up in the air. It was not resolved in the mind of the producer of that show. That show is going to get excellent ratings, and they are going to run that one again.
What perception? I know it's coming up again. What perception do you think the viewer was left with?
The viewer was left with the same perception that Richard Price left in the article that he wrote, the very excellent article he wrote in USA Today, another example of a mainstream media that is taking a much more sophisticated and intelligent approach to this. And that is that what have things come to? In the 50 years since the end of World War II, when massive lights can appear over a major city of our country, regardless of whether some National Guard planes dropped them or not, and the government does absolutely nothing, and then one finally approach says it doesn't investigate such things, we don't do that, you look into it, and then when pressed even further months later, finally comes up with some statement about National Guard planes, stonewalls, and is evasive.
As I recall, though, now maybe the Discovery Channel got around this, but as I recall, there was a statement by the National Guard, a captain, who said, yes, we dropped flares, but I recall she also said, I want to be very, very careful that you understand that the flares that we dropped do not explain the totality or anywhere near the totality of the lights that were seen on March 13th.
Well, they even posed in the video a theory, which they aired, in other words, they gave it some airing, that earlier sightings of people near the base, of jets taking off and moving in the direction of the original lights, mm-hmm. they were taking off in a fashion that they were scrambling, seemed to imply a possible theory that the original sightings, the earlier sightings of the V-shaped craft, had elicited substantial response from the military. They had scrambled to intercept or investigate, and possibly had dropped the flares as a decoy, as a way of creating a bit of plausible deniability as they cruise around trying to find these sightings.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most telling things that came out in that video was the fact that the military base there, and the name escapes me at the moment, was contacted by a couple of people, official types, wanting to know if anything was going on, had they received any calls. And they were told by an official at the base that they had not gotten any calls on that, and that's why they weren't looking into it. Later on, they discovered that the base was swamped with calls. So this video hit all the buttons. It really covered it all, and yet it didn't completely cave into a UFO-based explanation, per se. And then the other thing that's important here is this was Discovery. Now, most people may not know that the Discovery is a subsidiary channel, the Learning Channel. It's kind of like the second-tier channel.
Sure.
There's things that will run on that. It will not run on Discovery, which is trying to maintain a certain, how would you say, level of acceptance and
yes.
credentials and so forth.
Yes.
It's on the Learning Channel that has become the all-alien cable channel, all aliens all the time. They are running a series of documentaries over and over and over again, which is highly significant, but they don't run on Discovery. This Phoenix show was run on Discovery itself, and for them to run a show that clearly raises the UFO issue, does not resolve it, pokes holes in the standard government responses, which we are so used to, we know them all by heart, is an indication that that very significant station is moving its editorial policy slowly around, and that is indicative we're going to see higher level expositions of this material, maybe at higher level channels and higher level media. This
All right, obviously, Steve, it got good ratings because I have information here showing that Discovery is going to re-air that program on November 9th.
Now, they're going to love those ratings.
I hope that's right, and everybody needs to check their local guides. But November 9th, or possibly the 10th, I think the 9th, do you have any information on that?
I heard something along those lines, but I don't have a firm number. Obviously, you could call Discovery in Bethesda, which, by the way, is just up the street from me, about all of 8 blocks.
I see.
And find out. But it is going to be rerun, and don't be surprised if it's not rerun again. And again, and then shoved down to TLC to join the rest of their alien documentary and UFO documentary.
Why do you think all of the sudden interest, Steve?
Oh, there's always been interest, Art.
No, I mean a higher level of interest. Let's
well,
put it that way.
You see, that gets into what we're going to talk about. So, can we push that back a little bit and kind of go back to the beginning?
We certainly can. Okay. Stay right there, Steve Bassett, a UFO lobbyist in Washington D.C., and we'll find out, by the way, who his real clients are. We'll ask him that. I don't know if that's a question you're supposed to ask a lobbyist or not, but we'll ask him anyway. And I would like you to know that if you go to my website and go down into the guest area, you'll see the name Steve Bassett. Click on Stargate International, and it'll take you right over to his website where the petition that you can fill out resides. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Steve Bassett, a UFO lobbyist? Question mark. A lot of people go, huh? A UFO lobbyist? In Washington, D.C., a real one? Really? I didn't know there was such a thing. Well, we'll explore all of that with Steve in a moment. Couple of items on the web for you to note. One, there are three new, very good UFO photographs on my website to see right now. Item one. Item two, there is a new book signing photograph taken by somebody who happened to come late and sent to me. Thank you very much. I didn't take this one, obviously. I'm in it, and Ramona is in it as well. This was the book signing down in San Diego, actually Escondido, for the Quickening. But in this particular photograph, and the reason I add it to the collection of book signing photographs, is because arriving right at the very end of the book signing was, guess who? Richard C. Hoagland and David John Oates. And in this photograph, you will see, I'll be there, of course, and Ramona, but then left to right behind us is David Oates. And what a blow away that was. I know what everybody's talking about now. David didn't look a bit like I thought he was going to look like. Wait till you see David Oates. And beside him, to the right of him, of course, the incredible Richard C. Hoagland. So you're going to want to see that. So we've got new UFO photographs. We've got the new book signing photograph where you can get a look-see at David Oates. And we've got a link, very importantly, folks, we've got a link to Stephen's site, Stargate International. Take over to Stargate International. Just go down to the guest section, and you can get the petition that may break this whole damn thing open. Now, this is where we return to Steve Bassett in Washington, D.C. I guess we better begin at the beginning. The whole UFO thing, Steve, has plagued all of us, fascinated all of us now for years and years and years and years. And for all those years, everybody said, damn it, when are we really going to finally get some sort of honest information from the government, some sort of investigation, some sort of congressional hearings, something official? And I guess in that area, you're the guy to tell us.
Well, there's a lot of people out there with opinions on this, and mine is an opinion. But I made a statement on the last time I was on your show, which I will reiterate here.
Please do.
Nothing that has happened since that appearance, I think it's been about 2 months,
mm-hmm.
has changed my mind on this. If anything, some things have happened which have helped to convince me. And so let's start off the show on a positive note.
Okay.
The statement is this, that based upon my assessment of what I'm seeing going on, which is a personal assessment, that the within the next 12 to 14 months, prior to, I believe the deadline on this is prior to the beginning of the primary season in the 1999 election season, which is about 14, 15 months away, April, the government will be forced into a position where they will have to disclose their fundamental posture on the UFO evidence and will, in fact, acknowledge the validity of the alien hypothesis.
Prior to what date again? I'm sorry.
Prior to just about the primary season of the 99 election. So you're talking about April 99.
April of 99.
12 to 14 months.
So you think before April of 99, the government is going to be forced to make some sort of official announcement?
Yes. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this.
Yeah, there's got to be a lot of
We need to talk about those reasons.
Very heavy forces moving.
One metaphor to use is this. Probably some of your listeners play chess. If you play chess, you know that chess has three games, a beginning, a middle, and an end game. Mm-hmm. And if you know a little about chess and you walk up on a game in progress, very quickly you can determine what game that is underway, middle game, beginning game, and end game.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at this whole process from that point of view, we are in the end game. And you can almost kind of count the moves that are left on the table to play. And so our show tonight is about the things that are going on which are behind this assessment. And let's face it, I'm willing, you know, I may be wrong, and if I am, I'll come back sometime in 99 and you can dish these words up to me and we'll sprinkle a little sugar on them and I'll eat them.
All right.
But I'm willing to take that chance right now. So that's what I want to talk about. But before we launch into that, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping. I've gotten a bit of criticism because I have not been clear about who I am representing.
Right.
And this is not unreasonable.
You are a paid lobbyist, correct?
Actually, I'm not a paid lobbyist. I work pro bono.
You work pro bono?
Yes. All my consulting lobbying is pro bono at this time.
How do you live?
Such a deal. Basically, I knock over 7-Eleven. No, that's not it. I have some concomitant means and so forth. But because I'm talking about a lot of things and people don't know who I'm representing, I think some feel it's not appropriate to not know because that way they can better assess my remarks, and I think it's fair. When you register as a lobbyist organization, this is public information. It is formally put out. It's published in political papers here in town.
Sure.
So this is not secret stuff. And because we're talking about political activism, it's not inappropriate. So very quickly, I'm a consultant and registered lobbyist working with, one, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, CSETI, which was founded by Stephen Greer. The Enterprise Mission, which of course was founded by the inestimable Richard Hoagland.
Yes.
Stargate International, which was founded by Robert Dean and his wife Cecilia Vindiola Dean. And Operation Right to Know, which was founded by Mike Jameson and Ed Komarek and is currently directed by Mary Kerfoot.
So in a sort of way, you represent a consortium.
I represent these, each group I represent, they're not in a consortium with each other,
right.
But they represent, essentially, they have some common interests, obviously,
yes.
And I'm talking with a couple of other groups, very likely will represent shortly. Now, what this means is it makes it a little easier to get, to line some vectors up and to focus some of the efforts and some of the interest that people have into political action. Clearly, this has some value. Most of the people in this field generally are looking for the same things. Lord knows there's plenty of controversy. But when you get down to the core, the people really are looking for primarily the same things. And to the extent that people are operating totally independently, this is a diffusion of energy. So to the extent that I can get as many groups I can go in representing as many groups as possible. It provides a little bit more impact, and
yes.
I'm able to get a little more attention, both from political operatives as well as the media. Along those lines, if I may, just for a moment, if there are any organizations, UFO researchers or activist groups out there that feel they would benefit from pro bono representation in Washington, D.C. of that type, they may contact me along those lines at my email, which is paradigmrg@aol.com. That's all one word, paradigmrg@aol.com, and I'll be happy to talk to them.
Now, do it again. Paradigm O-R-G?
No, Paradigm R-G.
R-G?
Yeah. Paradigm, letter R, letter G, at AOL.com.
At AOL.com, okay.
Now, having said that, let's talk about what's happened since I was on the show last. There are a number of things going on. The way you need to think about this is think about the government's posture, right, which is kind of an ephemeral thing. It doesn't have any substance. It's just a posture. Think of it as sitting in the middle of a circle, being encroached on from all sides. One of these sides, on one side encroaching on this, are the activities of several groups involved primarily in getting meetings with any entities within the government which can be constructive. Now, probably the foremost group along these lines is CSETI.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to comment on it a little bit.
All right.
UFO movement has always had some political activity going on since the very beginning, which we sort of pegged down in the very late 40s. So the politics of UFOs is not new. It has been going on. But for a host of reasons, which by and large, were not the fault of the people pursuing the political issues. There wasn't enough oomph to get all the way home. You had people who made it to first base, and some made it to second, but there was nobody around in third. In the early 90s, I think a very significant dynamic changed, and obviously there's a lot going on, and one could debate this, but from my point of view, this significant change in dynamic was the entrance into this political arena of Cicetti and Stephen Greer. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was significant was this. Stephen Greer is a very charismatic, a very thoughtful, very focused, and very intense person. These are qualities often associated with strong leaders.
Right.
And furthermore, his commitment included his personal resources. So when Cicetti made the decision to move into the political arena from some of the other things they were doing, and he threw his money into it, he was able to move forward very substantially in terms of making contacts, holding meetings, cross-briefings, and getting referred from one group to the other. And this sort of broke the ice, and I believe significantly changed the entire landscape for political action in a very meaningful way. And what the best way to describe what Cicetti has done is a phrase I like to use called forward coalitioning. If you take the entire UFO community, which is a fairly loose confederation, and you draw a circle around it, and then everything outside that circle we'll call the mainstream community,
right,
which is filled up with people that either don't know about it, know a little and don't care, or know a little or a lot and don't believe a word of it,
right,
which is most of the rest of the world,
mm-hmm,
then forward coalitioning is making contacts with people in that mainstream world who are in significant positions, who are in positions to take action or be helpful and constructive, but really have no involvement in any meaningful way in the, quote, established UFO community.
All right. In traditional lobbying, what moves the outside group is money.
Yeah, and that's not here. I mean, that's not a factor here.
In other words, Congressman so-and-so's re-election committee receives a check, and of course you get into the door. You don't have that luxury.
No, the UFO community has never had money.
So then,
and I want to
so
talk
then,
about that a little later in the show. But
fine. So then what do you do? Without the money, what do you do?
It's funny, Art, but there is an advantage to not having to deal in money. There's an advantage to working pro bono, which is something that Jonathan Turley is doing on the Area 51 case. There is an advantage with not having to worry about money issues with respect to people you're going to be talking to or in any way having to give money to a party. It frees you up. And this issue is a moral, an ethical, and political issue of fundamental importance. And once you get beyond the laugh curtain or beyond what we call the first line of defenses, nobody who is intelligent, reasonably ethical, fails to see that. And so it would almost be improper. Even if, say, we had a couple of million dollars, say we had $10 million handed to us on a silver platter,
okay,
it would almost be unethical, in my opinion, to take a bunch of that money and give it to a political party because you wanted them to help you pursue this issue in some formal way. Because this issue affects every living person on this planet.
But that's
it
how
transcends all parties.
Yeah, but that's how it's done.
Well, that's how it's done, but not in all things. Understand that a lot of things have happened in our country are very positive. A lot of changes have been made in this country by efforts that had virtually nothing to do with money.
All right, well, let me put it this way. When Stephen Bassett wants to call Congressman X or knock on Congressman X's door,
mm-hmm,
and you've got to get past the secretary to talk to the congressman.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you say Stephen Bassett generally ends up on the list of access behind all the guys with the tobacco money and the blah, 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 blah? Stephen Bassett's probably got to be down there at the bottom of the list when Congressman X has nothing else to do for that day.
Not necessarily, Art. If you're a member of the House or Senate at this particular time, when the entire financing structure of American politics is being assaulted from all sides, and
mm-hmm,
people are holding hearings on TV and generally making complete fools of themselves, when the general public is clearly shown its disgust regarding the buying and selling of politics in America, we spend, if we took about 80% of the money we spend on the presidential election alone, we could probably feed half of India for a year.
Right.
being able to deal on some issues and step forward on political and ethical and moral grounds is actually a pretty substantial plus. I don't think any politician right now is going to gain any ground because he's able to raise some money from special interest and then act accordingly. In fact, the politicians are running around Washington priding themselves, and they'll be first ones to tell you that they took a whole bunch of money in some issue and then completely voted the other way. I mean, so you would be surprised. Let us not forget that we're not dealing with anything trivial here. This isn't. There are a lot of important issues in this country. There's a lot of lobbyists in this town. I think it's 14,000. But there are very few issues that approach the magnitude of this one.
How many pro bono lobbyists are there, by the way?
Oh, pure pro bono all the way down. Not a whole lot. I think there's a lot of a lot of issues on social causes, which are very, very little money.
So you're
the UFO
telling us
movement is probably the lowest funded of all movements currently operating.
I'm sure it is. So you're telling us that there is a sort of advantage,
yes,
to being pro bono, and that might actually get your foot in the door when the $750,000 check wouldn't.
I will say this. I have contacted every member of the Senate, and I have gotten a couple of meetings, several meetings. I have gotten other responses back, at least of a polite type. The meetings that I have had have been constructive. One of them lasted for 2.5 hours. I don't want to get into too much detail here. It's not like keeping score. Let's just say that the level of reception for what I'm doing in this town is remarkable. But having said that, let me say something else, which is pretty important. I came into this business pretty late in the game. I'm a Johnny come lately, Stephen come lately, and I'm running around town and I'm talking to media and press and political individuals. I'm not getting derision. I'm not getting ridicule. I feel very positive about 90% of the conversations I have. It's easy to forget that the only reason that I'm able to do this is that a whole host of researchers slaved for decades, year after year after year, under the worst possible situation, against impregnable barriers,
sure,
tremendous ridicule, losing income, having their profession hurt, some people perhaps even in the 50s losing their life. Only because all of those people did that for 30 or 40 years am I suddenly able to come up at this particular time and maneuver in this fashion. I'm just lucky. It's nothing special. I don't have any particular charm or charisma. I am just lucky. We could name these people. You know who they are.
Sure.
Someday they're going to get the credit they deserve. But they went through hell.
Did the Francis Barwood victory help you?
Yes. I am referring to that frequently in my discussions. Again, I pointed this out in the last show. One of the very significant things about the Barwood case is this. The media, and I'm going to talk about Corso in relation to this.
Oh, Corso, good. All right, look, hold that thought. We'll come back and talk about Barwood and Corso after the top of the hour, so relax. Stephen Bassett, the nation's only UFO lobbyist, official lobbyist in Washington, is my guest. Lots to talk about. We'll be back to do it. This is Coast to Coast AM.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
My guest is Steve Bassett, who is the nation's only lobbyist in Washington for the UFO community. He represents all kinds of heavyweights in the UFO community. I use the word consortium. It's really not. It's a loose gathering of common interests with a man who's doing pro bono lobbying, which in itself must be quite a job in Washington. We'll get back to him in a moment. We're about to go back to Steve Bassett. For those of you just joining us, Steve Bassett is a UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. He does his work pro bono. That's right, pro bono. And as I bring him back, I've got a couple of items I want to hit him with before we basically continue. Steve, are you there?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to read you something that I consider fairly typical of the UFO community, which, frankly, most of the time doesn't get along very well with itself, which is a big problem, and I'm sure we could spend time talking about that. But this concerns you, and it's typical. So just let me read it, and then you can react. Art, don't trust Steve. Don't trust him until he explains his financial situation. What better way to sabotage UFO investigators than by posing as a UFO lobbyist in Washington? He's always talking out of both sides of his mouth. For example, last time he was on regarding cancer cases among ufologists like Stephen Greer, he just couldn't resist mentioning that they shared a high degree of tension in their work. Some of the things that he said, meaning you, Steve, about Francis Barwood, his own client, were far from flattering. Steve's comment about Kathy Keaton keeping hope alive on this issue of ufology for many years proves how cynical his real agenda is. So there you go, Steve. You get into this field, and people are going to, and what this basically, of course, is doing is accusing you of perhaps being a disinformation agent.
Art, I'll tell you, that's to be expected. I am aware of those kinds of things, and I'll be honest with you, I just don't want to put the effort into responding to it. It's an interesting subject, but there's other things to talk about. Perhaps at another time, someone wants to go to call and answer kind of thing, we get into that. But I'll make a very quick point, and I've said this to a number of people. The UFO world has had a very significant problem because it's somewhat inbred. Because it's had so many obstacles in its way, up against very, very intense resistance, very heavily funded and well-motivated resistance, and as the X-Files now continues to taunt us, it always is the next step and the next day and the next effort, the next slide, the next video, the next credential, never quite getting there.
Yep.
People are very frustrated. They can't fight City Hall. They're not winning those battles, and so they turn on each other. And one of the ways they do it is they accuse everybody of this and that. And one of the classic things is disinformation.
Yes.
Disinformation is something you can virtually not prove. You can throw it out any time you want. And so to the extent that it does that, it's really chasing its tail, just going around in circles. There's only one way to break that cycle, and that's this. Every piece of information that anybody comes forward with should be judged on its merits, period. And trying to figure out someone's motives or get into deep analysis of their psychology or doing a lot of research on their, quote, background is a lot of time and effort and money that could be spent on doing research on these issues. And if the material holds up, fine, work with it. If it doesn't, dispense with it. But getting into who's disinformation, who's government operative, and all this stuff, this is unfortunately kind of a syndrome that is a result of the way things have gone for 50 years. And I do not blame the community for this. This has not been a fair game. It hasn't been a fair playing field. And people are people, and it's not easy to work without money and without payoffs. I mean, my Lord, I remember way back in Colorado.
What motivates this kind of consistent allegation, though? Is it, in your opinion, is it jealousy or frustration?
I think it's mostly frustration. There's a certain amount of jealousy, but it's mostly just frustration. I think most of this people would prefer to direct this, I think, at the government if they had targets, but they don't. I can make two allusions here. One is that back in Colorado, this is back around 1980, I can't remember the year, 84, 85, I only heard Alan Hynek speak one time. He came to Colorado, and I heard him, and it was only about a month or two before he died. I didn't even know he was ill. But I remember the meeting, and I remember that he was struggling and that he wasn't particularly clear. In other words, his discussion was not as lucid as one would expect, and I didn't know what to make of that. But I could tell that he was struggling. 2 months later, he was dead. And, of course, then I realized that this man who had been in this issue and had done so much for so many years, and as you realize, of course, was nearly 10 years shy
yes.
of being able to live and see the result, was doing everything he could to the very end, right up to the end. That's the kind of dedication that's involved here. And that's what I think about when I think about when I'm having a problem or I'm a little discouraged. I think about people like Hynek, and I say, look, I'll never go through what they have to go through. And so I'm not going to get upset over those kinds of things. So let's move on. You ask about Francis Barwood.
Yes.
Let's talk about Barwood and Corso and the media
All right.
in context here. And then I'd like to go back to that circle that I was talking about, this encroaching on the governance posture. And then I've got a soundbite for you for this evening, which I think you will most definitely appreciate.
I've got a bit of a surprise for you, too, but go right ahead. Francis okay. Barwood. Let's begin
Here's the thing. The media operates under two fundamental premises and has on this issue for as long as we can remember. Premise number one, under no circumstances, with very few exceptions, do you ever do a straight UFO story. You just don't do it. And premise number two, whatever doubts you may have about not doing that story, you know, that you're missing out on something, or maybe there's really something here, and boy, there's a Pulitzer Prize, and not going to get it, or maybe we're going to get scooped.
Sure.
Don't worry about it, because nobody else is going to cover it either. All right? There's an unspoken kind of confederation going on here.
There is that mentality.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the way it worked. Okay, fine. But there are exceptions, and one of the key exceptions is when a UFO situation hooks to a legitimate story, and then all the frustration that these people have about maybe they ought to be covering this gives them a chance to really jump. Frances Barr was an example. She was a council person, and she worked in a real city, in a real council, and she got up and talked about this, raised a ruckus, got the governor involved. This is a story. It happens to be UFO-related, but so what? And, boy, the media was all over it.
Oh, yes.
They showed up, and it got a lot of exposure, got a lot of attention, helped her, in my opinion, has changed the landscape, in my opinion. This is all positive. And, as we know, has led to the Phoenix documentary on Discovery. So that's the way the media will operate. It's got to have the hook. In that regard, Francis Barwood was very significant here. What it's saying is that the media wants to get into this, but you need to find ways to hook the UFO reality into mainstream issues.
So the resolution of the Barwood case then represents kind of a crack in the dam.
Exactly. And that brings us to Philip Corso.
Okay.
With respect to Philip Corso, very interesting. You know, the people in this community, the research community particularly, have seen so many crazy and wild things.
Mm-hmm.
We've been agog so many times, taken aback, seen incredible videos and Lord knows what else, that we've kind of gotten jaded. I mean, something incredible comes along, we note it, we read the book, we put it down, it gets debated on the internet for a while, and we move on, right, to the
right.
next thing.
That's right.
It's easy to forget and to step back and take a look at some of these things and say, wait a minute, what just happened? Well, you really have to do that with Corso's book. This is an unbelievable event, an unbelievable book.
I know.
And so this thing gets published. Well, guess what? When that book was published, really that was a shoe dropping. The other shoe hasn't dropped yet.
Oh.
A lot of people, I don't think, are paying attention to this. Let's make an analogy. If Colonel Corso, with all the credentials that he has,
mm-hmm.
had published a book this year basically stating that while he was on President Eisenhower's staff, he came into information which clearly indicated that several of Eisenhower's cabinet members were feeding secrets directly to the Soviet government.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, while he was in military intelligence, he learned of several generals that were doing the same thing and were part of a secret cabal of Soviet spies within the government during the 50s and 60s. And then put that book out and published it. Let me tell you, very, very quickly, not only would the media be all over it, but the government would be doing some major investigations, and the fur would fly,
you
and the
betcha.
Cocoa would hit the fan.
You bet.
But he didn't do that, did he? He wrote a book which basically blew the cover on the Roswell situation. Now, guess what?
Now, it basically, I'll tell you. First of all, I did probably the two longest, most comprehensive interviews with Colonel Corso.
Right.
Now, his claims, of course, boil down to he had access to Roswell technology.
Right.
His job was to take that technology and integrate it into American industry,
mm-hmm.
and the claims are that fiber optics, and we could
yes.
go on and on and on, modern chip technology, all the rest of it, came not from some hard research,
mm-hmm.
but rather back engineering these items that Colonel Corso transferred to private industry. That is basically, in a nutshell, the Corso story. And
well, sensation. Plus, he also had access to files.
That's correct. And so I interviewed him for, I don't know, 6 hours total, something like that. Tremendous amount of information on the air. But you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Since Colonel Corso, I don't want to say has gone into hiding, but he has stopped doing interviews.
Mm-hmm.
He's not talking to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I'm not privy to that, but it is not illogical, I can assure you. He gave a press conference down at Roswell. It went very well.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few press there.
Right.
I had seen him, and I talked to him a little later.
That's one of the interviews I did when he was there.
I think I wouldn't focus too much about whether he's talking now or not talking now, but focus on this. Let me kind of finish that thought that I had.
Yeah, sure.
Corso publishes this book, and nothing has happened, really. Within the UFO community, plenty has happened, but in the main world, nothing has happened. Why? Very simple reason. Remember those two postures about the media?
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
No straight UFO story?
Sure.
Well, Colonel Corso's book is a UFO story, and they don't do UFO stories, all right? Now, the government is in an interesting position with respect to Corso, isn't it? It only has three options. Option number one, come forward with clear evidence that Colonel Corso, due to advancing age and other illnesses, has become essentially delusional, senile, and has acted inappropriately. It's very unfortunate. They hope that he gets care. They're willing to help him, et cetera, and everything in the book is nonsense.
Don't think they can make that case.
Second one, they can come forward and say these are incredible allegations,
mm-hmm.
which go to the core of the integrity of the government, and we are refuting them all, and here's the evidence refuting them. That's two. Or three, it can ignore him.
And that's what they're doing.
And they're ignoring him. Now, the reason they're ignoring him is because they know that the media posture will not cover it. Why? Because if the moment the government responds to Corso, that is a legitimate story.
Of course.
That is a coverable story.
Of
and
course.
The moment they do it, the media will be all over it. And so they're playing the same game they've done many times before.
Plus,
and they're getting away with it
plus,
now.
Plus, of course, Steve, the government's history of response to UFO allegation is very poor indeed. Witness the,
sure.
you know, witness the Roswell response. Pathetic.
But it's getting better. It is changing. And this, Barwood is an example, but I can give you many others. The government is playing a very careful game. It is playing a dangerous game, and it's running out of room and time. It's thinking that somehow this is the same old scheme from years ago, that this thing will just fade away. Well, the internet wasn't there years ago, and the level of awareness wasn't there, and the documentaries on TLC were not there,
mm-hmm.
and the extra hundreds of thousands of people that have really gotten relatively directly involved were not there. That's no longer the case. This is not going away. So we're sitting there waiting for the other shoe to drop, and the media is sitting there not doing anything yet. Well,
mm-hmm.
let me give you your first soundbite of tonight.
All right.
A major daily is entering into editorial discussions this week regarding the initial, how can I phrase this, editorial level discussions regarding the gathering information so that they can make a decision to put their full investigative resources behind going directly after the issue of witnesses, witness pool, congressional hearings, and testimony such as the public already given testimony such as Corso.
This is a major daily we would all recognize.
It's a major daily, so everybody's going to recognize a major daily. Now, I cannot say which one it is at this point,
mm-hmm. Okay.
But that will become apparent soon enough if they choose to act. If they choose not to, that's another story. Now, the implications of this are enormous. Because remember that second tenet? There are people out there in the conspiracy world that feel comfortable. It makes them feel more comfortable if they believe that all of the newspapers and all the media in this world are in a giant cabal run by a greater power, and it's all orchestrated. Well, this is just too simple and too easy. It's not the case. The media in this country has brought down presidents. It has gone after every sacred cow you can point at. It has brought down governments. Believe me, when it gets motivated, nothing gets in its way. And if a major daily goes into this issue, not, you know, trying to prove Roswell per se, but going into the testimony issue and who wants to testify and what was Corso talking about, the moment they start that series, most of the rest of the papers are simply not going to sit by and read the greatest story of all time.
Of course, and let it go. Okay. Thank now, suppose I'm that major daily, unnamed daily newspaper,
right,
and you're coming to me trying to make a case that I should expend my resources in this area. What do you tell me that is strong enough, powerful enough, to make me want to devote my resources to going after this?
I'm a little limited here. Without getting into too much specifics, let's just say that I think there's a relatively strong awareness in the public domain about the gathering witness pool, which brings us back to, let's go back to that circle. Remember the government posture in the middle of an encroaching circle?
Yes, sir.
We talked about the intensive meetings of CSETI for 5 years, which are still going on. That is one point of the compass. Let's move to another point of the compass. Another thing that is encroaching on the government posture is that the fundamental government cover-up is leaking like a sieve. Now, it has been for some time, but the leaks are just getting bigger and bigger.
Mm.
More people coming forward, people loosening up, feeling a little more less fear about sticking their nose out. So the witness pool continues to sort of accumulate like water dripping into a pool. And there are people that represent those witnesses. So if I were, we're speaking purely hypothetical now. If I were the editor of a major daily, and someone could come and give me a pretty substantial picture of the quality of that witness pool, government people, rank stations, types of testimony, levels of testimony, implications, and I was fairly convinced that these people were there and ready to go, I think that I might decide it's time to get on the saddle and get into this issue pretty big.
And you would make that decision based
on... That's an editorial decision. That's a different thing, a story meeting and an editorial meeting. You have an editorial meeting with a paper.
But look, even newspapers, broadcast media, we are all driven by ratings. Ratings which equal money.
Well, that's the point, Art. Let's say I've had some success in demonstrating that the potential ratings impact could be quite substantial.
All right. Hold that thought, Stephen. We'll be right back to you. Stephen Bassett, a UFO lobbyist in Washington, is my guest. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from November 3rd, 1997.
Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll turn her music.
Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 3rd of November, 1997.
My guest is Stephen Bassett. He is, as far as I know, the nation's only UFO lobbyist in Washington, D.C. and does his work pro bono. For those of you with the money questions, there's your answer. He does his work for these loosely associated organizations, at least from a interest point of view. He does that work pro bono. So now what are you going to complain about? We'll get back to him in a moment. Stephen Bassett now back on the air. And, Stephen, here's yet another fact. Maybe you can deal with this question. Art, I believe in the existence of ETs and UFOs, but I must disagree with Steve on just the following point. And actually, I don't think you're disagreeing. He goes on, until UFOs and ETs have an adverse effect on our way of life, which is somehow clearly documented in the mainstream media, there's going to be no great revelation on the subject by our government. Our politicians are driven by bread and butter issues, crime, taxes, that sort of thing. In the meantime, he wishes you luck, but doesn't think you're going to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm. It's not an unreasonable position to take, but I think that my best response to that would be this, that if these inside cabal-type situations always had their way, and the media and citizen action really can't bring about what we call defined results, then the Vietnam War would have lasted 8 more years. Johnson would have served a second term. Nixon would have served his term out. The fact of the matter is all this is happening in the real world. There are plenty of people involved. This is not a simple thing. It's not a chess game between two people. It's a chess game between probably about a couple hundred, 300 people in the government and about 2 million people on the outside.
Oh, yes.
So let's just wait and see. Remember, I'm prepared to eat my words in April of 99.
You say those words one more time for the audience that joined us at midnight. Your prediction is that by April of 99, what?
The assessment is that the government, no later than the beginning of the primary season for the presidential election in 99, which is April, about 15 months away. Prior to that, not next month likely, but within 12 months, 14, 15 months, the government will be forced to disclose its position and will, based upon certainly my assessment of the field, be forced to acknowledge the validity of the alien hypothesis as the explanation for the UFO phenomena. It is an inevitability that we've been heading for 50 years. And we're getting near the end of the line. And what we're talking about tonight is why that's going to happen. We were talking about the second point of the compass, in other words, this encroaching circle that's closing in on the government posture, and that's the leaking cover-up, which is a good metaphor, leaking people who are pooling together, in a sense, outside the circle, growing larger and larger, whose stories are inevitably going to be told in one fashion or another. Let's move to the third point of the compass in this circle. That is constituted by what I call much more direct action. In other words, pointed directly at the government for specific purposes. Examples of this are straightforward as Operation Right to Nose activities. They started what I call direct demonstrations on this issue. Obviously, this isn't an anti-war issue or the Vietnam War, so we're not talking about huge demonstrations, but they were out there. All the way back to 91, demonstrating in front of the White House, Washington Post, GAO.
Right.
A lot of that activity was organized and directed by Elaine Douglas, who is the also, in addition to belonging to Operation Right to Know back then, is now the director of MUFON in the District of Columbia, MIT graduate, very sharp. They were simply punching on the door, and the media was showing up and covering it. This is direct action.
Occasional coverage, but
nothing extensive. But in addition to that, you've got the FOIA activity, the Freedom of Information Act activity,
right.
All the way back to the 70s, and that's associated with the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy cause. Now, one of the original founders there was Peter Gersten. He's still important because he's still in play, and he's still working on behalf of cause from his points of travel that he's doing. And one of the things he's doing right now, which we need to update on, is that he filed recently a Freedom of Information Act request specifically, and this is a very, very tight request, for information on Colonel Corso.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, the government, unlike most Freedom of Information requests, is in a very tough position on this one, isn't it?
Well, it is because it's so specific, yes.
Yes. It's going to be, Corso has said there are records. He has alluded to specific things. The government has to either deny they exist, which immediately opens the story for the media to jump on,
right,
or it delivers the goods. Now, what's happened is that Gersten has gotten back the first-level response, which is basically Colonel who? And he now has gone to the appeal level. The next step is to go into courts. This is something he's done many times. He's used to it. He anticipates being in court by about Christmas.
Well, how can they say Colonel who? Now,
I'm joking. they basically, I think, referred him to the Air Force, which is then going to refer him to the archives, which is then going to say we don't have anything. I mean, it's the usual thing. I mean, it would be astounding. If they actually come forward with the Roswell records, well, hey, no problem. But he's anticipating that not happening. Now, this FOIA stuff, he's not the only one that's filed FOIAs. But these things have been kind of like a Chinese torture for the government. Just drip, drip, drip.
Yes.
And it's brought a lot of information out. As you know, it's established several key points, namely that saucers are real. In other words, the government has information pertaining to sightings and blips and so forth. It's also confirmed some of the government's positions on some of these things. And some interesting clues have been ferreted out. And it's also kept the thing in the legal process and built up a legal sensibility about this. So that's direct action. Now, if I could be so presumptuous, I'd like to maybe suggest, Art, that Peter, who is a really interesting guy and goes all the way back to 78 and knows the legal side of getting this information out as well as anybody, is somebody that you may want to consider bringing on the show, particularly in the light of his ongoing FOIA on Colonel Corso.
Okay.
Which is going to eventually have to resolve itself. The government eventually has to take a position. Now, if it eventually takes a position that there are no documents, it is de facto saying that Colonel Corso is nuts. And that is a story. And I can assure you that I, and I'm sure others, are not going to let that story go by without making sure the media understands what that means. So Gersten's activities and cause and Operation Right to Know, this is coming at the government. And it's using legitimate legal structures, which can't simply be completely ignored. And then let's go around to the other side of the circle, to the last compass point.
Sure.
And there is what I would call mainstream citizen action. And the best example of that, in my opinion, right now, is the petition movement. There have been many.
This is under the category, folks, of what you personally can do right now.
All right, let's talk about that. Let's talk about this fourth point of the compass pointing in toward this government posture. Let's talk about the rest of the country and the rest of the UFO community. What can they do? Well, let me tell you what you can do. First of all, join an organization. Join MUFON. Join CSETI. Join Stargate International, Operation Right to Know, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, FUFOR, KUFOS. They're all over the place. You've taken them for granted to some degree. Join them. Send them the $15 or $20 or whatever they do. If you want to send lots of money, hey, do that. But join the organization. Start building up the numbers because now would have significant impact. That's one thing you can do.
But a lot of people are not joiners. So
no,
here is something they can do. If they'll go to my website, go down to the guest section, click on your name, they'll go over to Stargate International's website. Is that
right?
That's their website, not yours really, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there is a copy of the petition that you can fill out, because you are hoping to take, what, a million signatures, plus signatures?
Let's talk about that. Let me talk about that. It's very interesting you've gotten into that. First of all, let me give out a couple of other quick locations. Not URLs, so I'll give you a word search. The petition is also on MSN's UFO Forum site and word search on UFO Forum.
Right.
It's supposed to be on. I thought it's up. Maybe it's not up yet. Sightings on the radio.
Yeah, I got word that it wasn't.
Okay, well, I know they were intending to do it. Perhaps there's a glitch. Maybe they've changed their mind. I'll look into it. It's up on the ORTK, or Operation Right to Know, will be shortly up on the ROTK site. And, of course, it's up on your site. Now, there may be some others that I don't know about. But, nevertheless, it is up on some sites. You can find it using these word searches.
My site will be most familiar to my listeners, and there are millions of them. So I'm telling them right now that they can go there right now and fill out this petition. Now,
absolutely.
Exactly what is it we're petitioning for? What does the petition say?
Art, hang on one second.
All right.
And then I'd like to talk a little bit about the Internet, because the Internet is playing a very significant role in this business.
Oh, yes.
And it needs to be stressed, I think, in case people, lest they forget what's going on. Here's what the petition says. This is a petition, again, originated by Stargate International, non-proprietary. It's intended to be the community's petition. It's intended to try to represent as many groups and people as possible. It is perhaps the right petition at the right time, we hope.
Okay.
And this is what it states. I, the undersigned, petition my Congress to hold in 1997 an open hearing in which government, military, civilian contract, an and agency employees, active and retired, are permitted to give testimony regarding their personal knowledge of any UFO-related evidence. This testimony to be given under immunity by waiver of any applicable security oath or agreement of nondisclosure.
Mm.
Now, let me clarify something here. First of all, I'm going to make something very clear. UFO-related evidence. This petition was written to be as simple as possible so that there'd be a minimum amount of confusion and consternation on the part of the average person that reads this. But UFO-related evidence, let me be very unambiguous. It refers to everything that is related to the UFO and obviously behind it the alien hypothesis that anyone working for the government at any time has encountered in any way. And that takes in, obviously, sightings. It takes in any NASA evidence. It takes in any of the photographic evidence that may have been seen by, erased by, referred to regarding Moon and Mars artifacts.
Crash and recovery evidence?
Absolutely. It refers to video stuff that may have come off of the space shuttles. It refers to any thing that the government may have dug up somewhere archaeologically on this planet. It refers to anything behind the UFO and alien hypotheses. That could have been stated perhaps more elaborately, but the intent was to try to keep that petition as tightly written as possible. And the witnesses that are pooling, that essentially, hopefully, will eventually testify at this hearing, cover that entire range. It's not just some people are going to come forward and say, I saw a sighting, I saw a craft.
Right.
They're going to be covering a whole range of things which, in their totality, paint a pretty broad picture and a pretty thorough picture of what we already know fairly confidently to be the general state of affairs.
Let us say, for the sake of argument, that you get well over a million signed petitions asking for this.
Yes.
Is it not possible that upon their delivery, even though it obviously would create a great deal of interest, the section which would hold people harmless from the documents they signed regarding national security, mm-hmm. just wouldn't get passed?
Well, that's up to the government, and that is the linchpin to this. Clearly, it gives them an excuse. They can say, "Oh, we can't ever do that." And that, of course, gets us eventually. We'll get into that at length when we talk about Area 51. But you know, I'm not getting much resistance on that issue. The resistance is fundamentally, perhaps, along the lines of, is there really anything there? I don't think that when push comes to shove, providing immunity to these people, and the interesting thing about it is the provision of immunity, which really is what the particular committee involved is going to be doing. That's the service they're going to be providing. That's what makes this hearing possible. The people that are going to have to make the decision about holding this hearing are not going to have to debate amongst themselves and whoever else wants to join the debate some particular aspect of the UFO evidence. They're simply allowing people that want to talk. I mean, that's pretty simple. It's not rocket science. And these people are requesting protection from problems. Whistleblower issues are very well known
right.
in the government.
It's hard to imagine, though, that even if the best happened and they issued the immunity, went along with the whole thing, held the hearings, I can't imagine they'd be public.
Well, there's certainly none of the people that I'm working with have any desire with closed hearings. I think that certainly some vetting of some of the witnesses, perhaps, with respect to some things that might be a problem, will be possible. This is, remember, I look forward to those negotiation processes. When we get to the point
sure.
where you're actually debating or negotiating some of the particulars of a hearing like this, we are well along the way. But let's don't jump too far ahead. And let's also keep in mind that these hearings probably will not take place without a considerable amount of media input. And so once the media gets involved and starts picking at this, it's going to be pretty hard to suddenly slam dunk some sort of secret meeting. Remember that, I don't know if anybody listening remembers the last time we had hearings, which is 30 years ago. Tragically, I actually remember that very well. But the 66 hearing, there were three people that testified. I think one was General Brown, one was McDonald, and one other, that was it. Right? It's like holding this whole giant hearing on financing and have three people come in, talk about financing and then shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously a ruse, but That's not going to happen now. We're way along the way from that.
No, I don't think that would happen, not if you actually got to hearings.
No.
Listen, we'll pick back up on this after the top of the hour. I want to get something in before the top of the hour.
Okay.
My program has been on the air for 14 years. Several years ago, I began to shift the emphasis of the program away from everyday kind of politics in discussion.
Right.
Two issues like the one we're discussing right now. And I did that, Steve, basically because I began to come to the conclusion that politics, at least in the last few years, has, for the most part, been irrelevant to the everyday lives of most Americans, and they were getting, frankly, frustrated, bored, and disinterested in it. And I was one of those Americans. And so I began to change the focus of the program several years ago. And I got a very, very interesting facts earlier today from the Republican National Committee.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they said, we understand that you have changed the focus of the program. Back when I was doing pure politics all the time, to have the Republican National Chair on the show would have been impossible. They wouldn't have come on my program. And yet, they sent me a fax and said, dear Art, would you please have RNC Chairman Jim Nicholson on the program tomorrow night?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have him on the program for a short period of time, Stephen, tomorrow night.
Great.
The RNC chair.
Yeah.
So
I love it.
So, oh, good. I'm glad you do. Now,
I would think the DNC chair would want to show up pretty shortly thereafter.
I'd be glad to have him. But I, as of tonight, I can tell you tomorrow night the RNC chair will be here. Now, he will be addressing, you know, some political issues back east and elections and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But given the opportunity, Stephen, to ask the RNC chair one question, what would you ask? Because, see, I can ask for you.
Boy, you know, that you surprised me there, and I must admit that's a meeting I'd love to have. And what would
sure
I ask?
That's right.
Well, one of the problems with that question is that essentially you're really in a partisan position there. You're talking to a man who's clearly heading a partisan party. I mean, he's in a very partisan position with respect to a particular party. This issue is certainly nonpartisan and transcendent.
Well, having said all this, by the way, and now airing what I'm airing right now, I may get a call tomorrow, sorry he can't make it, previous engagement, whatever, who knows. But assuming that he does show up and we can ask one question that would relate to your kind of work.
The question I would ask would be more related to the Area 51, and I'll posit it this way. I'll basically say this.
All right.
I'll say, in the 50 years since the end of the war, we wrote the government a blank check, basically said, look, prosecute this Cold War, keep these nukes off of our back, do whatever you got to do, spare us the details. And the government did. It spent trillions of dollars, built huge infrastructures, intelligence agencies, vast covert operations, secret activities, black budgets, the whole nine yards.
Yes.
Built up this huge edifice.
All right.
The Cold War's over. This edifice hasn't gone away. We are operating with huge amounts of secrecy and classification.
The question is, real quick.
The question is, isn't it time for this to be dismantled? We only need maybe 5% of all this stuff. Do you think it's time to get back to a more normalized government?
All right, we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
Stephen Bassett is my guest. He is a UFO lobbyist. Pro bono work is what he does in Washington. We've discussed many, many things during the course of the program. We're going to finish up with the Area 51 case. That is as much as we're able to talk about here shortly. And then we're going to open the phone lines. And if you have a question for Stephen, I guess the time would be now. And I've got a good one for him in a moment. are three new UFO photographs on my website that are definitely worth a look-see. There's also a new photograph up there as part of the book signing photographs that I think you would want to see. It includes, in the background, Richard C. Hoagland and David John Oates, who both came late to the book signing, and someone took a photograph of all of us and sent it to me, so I scanned it and got it up there. I thought you might want to see what David Oates looks like, and I think you'll be quite surprised. I was, and David, of course, that always occurs, doesn't it? I see it all the time. People see a photograph of me after hearing me for years, and they say, oh, my God, I thought you were fat and bald, and you're not. Or it goes the other way, and they say, gee, I pictured you this way, and you look that way. Usually people that you hear for a long period of time and then finally see never, ever meet up somehow with what your mental impression of them was. So if you want to see that photograph, it's up there. And perhaps most important of all is the link to Stephen Bassett's to his, I keep saying his website, and it's really not his website. He's simply involved. He is assisting Stargate International's Coalition for Honesty in Government. And the petition that you can fill out, all it'll cost you is a little time, is there. So you go up to my website, scroll down to the guest section, you'll see Stephen Bassett's name. And there's a link there. When you hit it, you'll go over to Stargate International's Coalition for Honesty in Government, and you'll see that petition. By all means, get up to my website, jump across, and fill that out. That really, really is important. Now, you heard earlier Steve Bassett's proposed question for the RNC chair, who I tentatively have scheduled for tomorrow night. When he hears all of this, he may not come on. Who knows? However, if he does, as opposed to Steve Bassett's question, the following question is proposed by a faxer, and I want to run this by you, Steve, and see if you would prefer it asked. Okay, my faxer says, Steve's question is a gigantic softball. I would phrase a question like this, quoting me. I have a national audience in the multi-millions. It is composed of a cross-section that represents constituents from all walks of life, including but not limited to scientists, engineers, physicists, truck drivers, physicians, homemakers, police personnel, factory workers, corporate employees, CEOs, you get the idea. I receive literally thousands of verbal and written inquiries about the subject of UFOs and related issues. It is clear that most of these questions come from people who are reasonable, knowledgeable, well-informed, and rational. In caps, would your party be willing to incorporate in your ongoing operating platform a commitment to have the Republican leadership in Congress conduct open public hearings on this subject?
Touche. Two comments on that, Art. First of all, I'm a baseball player, so I'll tell you what you do. Lob him my softball.
Mm-hmm.
Real slow across the plate. Get his reaction times down. Then fire that fastball right at him. I think that would be a good approach. And what's intriguing about that question is this. This is going to get back to Frances Barwood.
Yes.
Frances Barwood is seriously considering running her Secretary of State campaign.
Oh, yes, I know.
Which I think Discovery Channel has nicely launched for. And making the UFO issue, the core fundamental UFO issue, part of that campaign, essentially nationalizing her effort there. And in a sense, she'll be doing what this fellow is, or person, this fact writer, is suggesting that the National Committee do. Interestingly enough, it's more likely to happen at the level of a Frances Barwood. And the reason is very simple. It's money. One of the problems these politicians have is that, say you're a senator, and your party and your backers just spent, say, $12 million getting you elected. You've got a whole range of issues that they're hoping you'll pursue. The moment you want to talk about UFOs, their immediate reaction is your ability to pursue those other issues is going to be destroyed. We just invested $12 million bucks in you. What are you doing?
I know.
someone at that level of Frances Barwood, where she's going to run an inexpensive campaign, it's not going to cost a lot of money, she's not owing to anybody or beholding to anyone, she really can raise the issue into a state campaign like that in an appropriate way and not be overwhelmed with resistance. So and still accomplish the job. So
well, Steve,
may run an historical campaign.
Yeah, I've never had the RNC chair on before, and this may ensure that I never will have him on again. Listen, there are a lot of people who would like to ask you questions, and I think we deserve to give the audience a little time with you. So how about that?
That's fine. I think the Area 51 we've wrapped up. Let me add one thing. If anybody is in the media or knows people in the media that would like to bring this case to their attention, email me at paradigmrg@aol.com. I will be happy to send you a full packet. Other people I recommend, contact your paper, contact your local politician. Mention this case is going forward and you want them to pay attention to it. There are some national implications here. I'm sure that they can use all the help they can get.
All right, good enough.
All right.
Here we go. Line one, good morning. You're on the air with Steve Bassett.
Good morning, ARL Art.
Good morning.
Since it's apparent that we have to broaden our interpretation of national security with grave geophysical and atmospheric and environmental threats announcing their imminence, any persons or entities that prevent the public from taking advantage of all of the apparently very capable assistances at hand to mitigate dangers is itself a threat to national security. And therefore, I want to commend your timely courage, and also yours as well, Art, for continuing to bring such guests on your program. Because since individuals with a different priority and loyalty have insinuated themselves into the government, we are all being put in jeopardy. My question, would you consider it to be an advantage to have some further very apparent manifestations of this higher order that's here to help us to be of any benefit in perhaps persuading leaders in this government and perhaps around the world?
You're not suggesting you can provide that, are you?
Pardon?
You're not suggesting you can provide those manifestations, are you?
I don't have the final say in these matters, but I am certain that...
well, look, let me...
an interesting issue, Art.
Well, he has. And now, Phoenix was quite a manifestation. More of those obviously would begin to change things, wouldn't it?
Yeah, he's raised a very interesting issue, and I think it's something that can't simply be overlooked, and that is that we can't lose sight of what the core driving force is. In other words, perceived evidence.
Yeah.
Some strong theories about some pretty fantastic stuff. I think, in general, particularly in the area of political action, I'm not a researcher, and I'm mostly focused on political action. There's plenty of people doing a lot of research and theorizing on this, and I love to do it, but it's not what I'm doing in terms of a formal way.
Right.
I operate completely aside from anything of that type, because it's virtually beyond the control. It's certainly beyond my control, and it's beyond the control of anybody else that I know or work with. And the moment that I allow that to come into play, really, I'm now almost building strategy on pure speculation. That is the wild card. I mean, that is the joker in this deck. And at any time, that card could be played. And that brings me to another question I'd like to throw at the RNC guy, and that is this. It's my view that when disclosure comes, and you know what my time schedule is, the party that's on the wrong side of this is ruined for a long time. Mm. And my question to them is, are you prepared to completely sit this out and just spectate it, or poo-poo it and have it blow up in your face and be off to the sidelines for, you know, 4, 5, 6 elections?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to take a stand?
Well, he was talking about manifestations, and I assume that he meant things like Phoenix and other very difficult to answer things that occur.
It could happen. It's not part of my strategy, no.
But look at what the gun lobby does, the anti-gun lobby. Somebody walks into a fast food restaurant, kills a bunch of people, and before you know it, there is 5 new bills hit the floor to restrict new guns or take guns away from people. So, in that sense, any additional manifestations would be of assistance to you, correct?
Oh, no, no, no. He's absolutely right. One of the, I think there's 2 points here. One is that certainly in the last few years, there's been an intense increase in very obvious phenomena.
Yeah.
There's been a tenor change, and this is a very significant factor, and I do allude to this, there's no question. But I don't seize on a particular thing and say, oh, look at this. This is so compelling that now you must do this.
I got you.
I rather, you let them know that this backdrop is occurring and continue to focus on really the total picture. And yes, there's no question. The Mexico sightings, all these footages are clearly driving some of this. And it is, again, and it is a legitimate part of that circle I'm talking about that's closing in on the government.
Well, if you finally get the hearings, these are going to be the things that are going to be part of the hearings. There's no question about that.
Well, it'll come up. I think, remember, the hearings are narrowly focused initially. Testimony of these government witnesses, employees, and so forth about their personal experiences. It's not structured to start off with UFO people in general coming in, talking about anything they want in the UFO field, which is vast. If a significant number of people testify under oath, under camera, with only a modest amount of their testimony redacted, I cannot imagine the Congress would say, oh, that's very interesting, thank you, now we're going to hold another hearing on congressional financing.
Well, all right, for example,
I think we'll move on to another level of hearing.
All right, for example, in the initial hearings, one might imagine Colonel Corso would testify.
I'm sure a lot of people would like it.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay, if he did, then we've opened Roswell up all over again.
Well, you have him under oath. I mean, if he testifies in a committee hearing under oath, I think even at that point, the New York Times, Washington Post, and other papers have got to say, well, he certainly is pressing this matter. He certainly is going awful far with this. Should we assign a reporter to this? Oh, I don't know.
Well, yeah, but look, remember the Schiff investigation, the GAO Schiff investigation, which found how many records missing? Just gone?
Yeah.
That,
sure.
Well,
covered it a little bit.
Yeah,
it covered the Schiff thing somewhat.
It's gonna open up all of that. All right. Absolutely. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Stephen Bassett. Hi.
Oh, great. How you doing, Art?
All right.
Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Okay, so you're not a UFO. I mean, you're not a researcher. I find that bizarre. You being a UFO lobbyist, nevertheless, I take it verbatim you follow the most popular sightings.
I'm pretty up on things, but again, a researcher is someone who's intensely focused in a particular area, and I don't have the background to do that.
Well, I find that kind of bizarre since you are a UFO lobbyist.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. Well, I mean, I'm sure he keeps aware and abreast of what's going on generally in the community, but he's not a researcher. He's
well, that's
doing,
where you're going to run into that block wall that says you're a disinformation.
No, you see, caller, you're missing the boat entirely. The block wall is a wall that sits there for researchers who come up with documentation of this or that and then don't even have a clue as to how to get it into the political system to actually get movement toward opening all of this up. So the caller is absolutely wrong. I'll just go on to another call.
He's raised a point, though, I'll mention, that is that one of the problems is this, and this is true of all issues. If you have a very controversial issue in play, let's pick one. Pick abortion, right?
Okay.
And you perhaps would like, you're a member of the staff of a congressperson, and you maybe want to get some information on it, discuss it a little bit. But you're going to have the head of the number one abortion rights group or abortion group come in to your office and sit there and have that get around. This is a very intense and difficult way to enter dialogue. It's much easier to deal with a lobbyist who's representing that group and maybe some others.
Yeah.
It's less obvious. You can have a little bit more of a reasonable discussion without getting it, quote, in bold italics. And so that's what I'm doing. It's not easy for these people to simply have some of the top researchers, UFO celebrities, as it were, walk into their office, have people notice that, have it possibly get in the press.
Look, it's impossible. Just take a name. I don't mind a name. Jim Delatoso. I've interviewed him many times. Really like Jim. Mm-hmm. It's like saying Jim would take his material and go and walk into a congressman's office with no knowledge whatsoever of how it's done in Washington. And so the caller, point made, I'll drop it right there. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stephen Bassett. Hello. Hello there.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, okay.
Where are you?
New York City,
okay.
On Long Island.
Yes,
on
sir.
Long Island.
All right.
And I don't share the optimism that in the near future the government is going to make any disclosure. And the reason why I believe this is because Michael Lindemann, he said that such an event would be a meta lever. But what means from that point in time in history, things are unpredictable. And also, concomitant with that is that we have Dr. Lear, who's pulling out implants in abductees, which the government would have. These are the questions that are going to be raised once you open up to subject. And I do believe there's a silent war going on, because I could personally verify some incidents that I have witnessed myself and have been documented by Dr. McAbee. I had a UFO encounter, but I don't want to take your time up on that. But I think the ramifications are so vast that I think the only choice the government has is to keep silent and let people gradually come along around to their own realization of what's going on.
All right, so you don't then share the optimism with regard to the timetable. How do you address that, Steve?
Well, first of all, I think he's in the majority, without question.
Oh, yeah.
And I think from where he's sitting, it probably is the appropriate response. I think one of the things is that remember, by and large, most of the UFO community is built around the research, the evidence, and the UFO forums and conferences,
right.
Which are slideshows and very interesting and exciting, and that's kind of the way it's gone. Most of the people in the UFO community, again, a loose community, pretty knowledgeable about the evidence. I mean, they can talk evidence all day long, but they don't know much about the politics, and they haven't followed it.
Hear, hear.
So they really don't have a sense of what's happening politically and media-wise.
And that's why we have you. All right, Steve, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from November 3rd, 1997.
Well, all right. We'll get back to Steve Bassett and your questions in a moment. Now to Stephen Bassett. Stephen, you've been a real trooper to stay with us as long as you have, and the lines are packed with people wanting to ask questions. So
let's take them on.
All right, let's take them on. First time caller line, you're on the air with Steve Bassett and Art Bell. Good morning. Where are you, please?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Ann from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. I just tuned in, so I'm not exactly sure what the topic is, but I do have a comment on UFOs.
What's that?
Basically, I've been listening for a while, and I just picked up that I think it would almost be better if the government did keep it from us.
Oh, now there is a very interesting perspective. Why?
Legitimate perspective.
Yeah, why?
Well, basically, I think that if the government let the general public know about it, there would be widespread chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have any hopes to make any form of communication with other life, we can't have people going around and, I mean, we're going to have to control it.
Actually, that's a very, very interesting perspective. And one worthy of your comment, Steve, there might be a social religious disruption. The Brookings report suggested that scientists would perhaps be the group most disrupted by it. It would change a lot of things very quickly, Steve.
She has touched on a very deep and complex issue. There's two probably important points that should be made. First of all, we've been through this before. if you go back in history, there have been a number of times in the history of civilizations where they've gone through major paradigm changes, which don't seem as severe looking backwards because we have all this knowledge that we carry around. Even the average high school student has a huge amount of knowledge of the world and science. But if you go back and try to put yourself in the mind of the people during some of these major changes, whether it's the Catholic Church hierarchy during the time of Galileo, you really can get a sense of just how profound it was. We've been through it before. We've survived. But there's another more important point. I think that we have a trade-off here. There's no question that this transition is going to be tough, and there's going to be consequences. But the one thing we have to deal with that transition, and this is true of every country on this planet, is the social contract that exists between the people of the state and the state. And there's a social contract between every group of people and the nation state they live in throughout this globe. And what is happening is that as this process continues to prolong, and as abuses of power and abuses of the social contract are engaged in to, quote, play this game,
mm-hmm.
the very contract by which we need to have intact to deal with these issues is being ripped to pieces. And so at some point, we risk a worse scenario in which fundamental trust in the government is gone.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of fractionization going on, and the disclosure comes anyway because, remember, there's a wild card in the deck. And talking about the Independence Day scenario, this disclosure can come regardless of what your politics are. And if that happens, I want that social contract to be intact. And right now it's getting a lot of hits. And so I understand what she's saying. It's a very tough call. And it may be that what we learn post-paradigm, we may say, gee, I sure wish I was dumb and barefoot.
Have you ever wondered, Steve, if you had somebody come to you, which could conceivably occur, literally with the smoking gun, undeniable, unambiguous, absolute evidence that would blow the whole thing wide open, and you had it sitting in your hot little palm, whether you would sit there all night or two nights or a week or a month considering the implications before you, say, went to, you know, the Times or Wall Street Journal or whoever you would go to with it to blow the whole thing up. I mean, would you have some reason to sit there and consider the implications for society before you let it out?
Well, of course, no one person will ever be in that position, and though it's, and it's, after I understand how broad this is, but
never say never.
I have thought about that issue many, many times, and I think most of the people in this field have at one time or another. There are unknowns here. There are some uncertainties. I liken it to a scenario. It's a hypothetical scenario, but I think it points it up pretty well. Let's go back to the time of Galileo, and let's imagine. This may have even happened, but I'm making it up. But let's imagine. Galileo goes to the top hierarchy of the Catholic Church, and he goes in with his telescope
mm-hmm.
that he's concocted.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what he's saying is, look, I've been looking through this thing, and I've discovered that Jupiter has moons around it.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be moons around it, which means that it's probably a planet like ours. And that has all kinds of implications, and I want to tell you about this. You've got to know this. And I've got the smoking gun. It's this telescope. Look through this telescope, and you'll see. And I can almost see the head of the church saying to Galileo, Galilei, I can't do that. And Galileo would say, why? He'd say, because, you know, if I look through that telescope, everything in the world will change forever. And so I'm not going to look through it, and everything will stay the same. And to some degree, we're playing out the same exact scenario. I think we've gotten to the point where the relationship between the people of this country and our government is every bit as important as the implications of this paradigm change. And it's complicated by the Cold War and what transpired there. When you factor these in, I have personally voted for pursuing this. I think in some degree, all of what we've gone through, all of the research, all of the effort, all of the blind alleys, all of the indoctrination, the meetings, the press conferences, the conferences with the slideshows, everything else, All of this is a process which, in some sense, is earning us the right to make this transition. Millions of people have been brought into play. Huge amounts of effort has been taking place. Much thought has gone into it. Perhaps the very act itself is taking us to the transition point, and it is totally appropriate. But if we try to operate from a guarantee of final result and try to calculate in advance whether how it's going to go, I'm afraid we will be frozen and we'll take no action whatsoever, and that's not the way human race works.
But again, that imaginary smoking gun in your hand.
If I had it, Art, I tell you, I would savor it. I would sit there and I would twist it over and I'd look at it and savor it.
I know, but even you, I'm going back to your own words now. You said that if revelation comes outside of the present political construct in this country, it could have social implications or political implications that would be so severe for the government that, we might bring a government down over it.
You're getting into some heavy stuff here. Let me tell you.
Yeah, sure.
Remember I told you about that government posture that sits in the middle of that encroaching circle? That government posture, which has evolved out of the Cold War, can be described in four catchphrases. This is the posture that has emerged from the Cold War into the 1990s. The posture of the government can be described by these phrases. Don't ask, don't tell. Need-to-know basis.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay?
All right, but you would have a choice. I mean, you could go to, you could blow the whole thing out in public, risking a final end game erosion in government confidence, or you could take your little smoking gun and you could go to Senator so-and-so and Congressman so-and-so, and you could try and say, look, I want to keep the present system together. It's the best in the world. I don't want to see it blown up. Here's my evidence. How are you going to handle it?
Well, this raises a question and begs an issue. You know, the fact is that, in a sense, what you're saying is if somebody had absolute power with respect to this issue one way or the other, what would they do?
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, that's the way the government operates. It operates from a position of near absolute power. The fact of the matter is that no one has absolute power on this. And no one is really in a position to really turn it one way or the other. And to the extent that it is being narrowed and kept confined, it is putrefying.
In other words, basically, you hate lousy hypothetical questions.
just because it's 5:40 in the morning, Art, doesn't mean you can hit me with a hypothetical
question. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Stephen Bassett. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Where are you, by the way?
I don't want to tell you my name and where I'm at. I'm investigating an incident that happened last April.
All right.
In Area 51.
Oh.
And I think you guys will be very interested in this. The death of John Denver was very unfortunate, and it got me to investigating this because he was flying a Long Easy aircraft.
That's correct, yeah.
Which is a Burt Rutan design, and subsequently Burt Rutan sent one of those out there. For,
well, they called it experimental.
Well, they always are. They're you know, under the aircraft Experimental Aircraft Association, but they've been out for many, many years.
Yes,
very tried and true. But
yes.
As you remember, there was a fellow by the name of Jimmy Joe, and I went back and listened to that tape.
Yes.
And apparently, he was taken down in Area 51. He was flying a Long Easy that he had claimed he had beefed up and overstressed.
That's a fact, actually.
Right. So the same kind of plane that John Denver had just purchased. And apparently John Denver had also overstressed a couple other aircraft, and in one high-performance aircraft it had a crash, apparently, that he had survived. So I got to checking on this and found some people in Texas, from Texas, that happens to know a Jimmy Joe. I won't say his last name. They've asked me not to. But the history on this fella, he hasn't shown up. He was flying out of Guam during the Vietnam era. And as you know, they have an Anderson Air Force Base over there. Prior to that, he worked for Ling Temco Vought in Grand Prairie, Texas.
Listen to me. I'm stopping you cold here. What I want you to do is to contact Steve Bassett privately. And anyway, we're toward the end of the show. So, Steve, how do people contact you again, please?
The most straightforward way would be email, which is, let me give you two. Email would be paradigmrg@aol.com. And they can call me.
Okay.
Should I give out a number already? Is this a bad idea?
It depends. What kind of number are you? I wouldn't give out my home number if I were you.
Well, no, it'd be the main business number.
let me give out. Actually, my number is listed if you want to go to the trouble. Address 4938 Hampton Lane, number 161, Bethesda, MD 20814.
You better do it again. People never can get it the first time.
I understand.
Time,
so. Yep. 4938 Hampton, H-A-M-P-D-N, Lane, number 161, Bethesda, B-E-T-H-E-S-D-A, M-D, Maryland, 20814. If there's possibility, if we have enough time, Art, there's a little something I wanted to get off my chest before we wrapped up.
All right. We do have a little time, so if you need to have it off your chest, go.
It's this. I'm going to lob a modest proposal in the general direction of the West Coast.
All right.
Look, for four decades now, a host of people who I won't attempt to name for fear to offend the ones that I forget, researchers and enthusiasts and people involved and interested have pursued this complex, extraordinary phenomena. They have had no money. They have suffered ridicule and derision. They have lost jobs and spouses and friends. They've suffered frustration and bad health. And they have pressed this forward to the point it's now converting into political action, and we've moved into the end game. At this point now, people in the mainstream are coming forward and taking considerable personal risk, jeopardizing their career perhaps, showing great courage. People like Stephen Schiff, people like Jonathan Turley, and I'm sure a few others will be stepping forward. We are near the end, and still, though, this field is virtually penniless. There is no money. People like Stephen Greer have come in and put virtually their entire savings and invested an entire life's practice into it. And that's fine, but much more is needed. There is an opportunity to drive some of these political processes with much more effectiveness. And I lob this proposal in the direction of those people who are the moguls of the entertainment industry and the moguls of the high-tech industry. These are individuals, in many cases, that have made large sums of money by incorporating a lot of this material into very, very entertaining and clever entertainment, which they have every right to do, and have made a fortune off of technology, which is an essence of our society and at the core of a lot of the UFO evidence. You know, they've made a lot of money, they're very wealthy, their lives are fulfilled, but they have a one-in-a-millennium opportunity, a one-in-a-eon opportunity to truly impact history. And if they would move to a more aggressive posture and direct some money toward the UFO community, particularly some of the political action, and I could sure show them where to send it, they can be able to say later on that they did more than just make movies about this or build a computer or build a software game about aliens. They can say that they were part of the transition that changed the world, and they can start helping us have the funds so that before this line is crossed, to get back to that girl's question, one of the things that is also needed is a whole lot of structure needs to be built up, a whole lot of citizen involvement and discussions and conferences. We need to get into this business seriously so that, in fact, we don't have the anarchy and the confusion that this young woman is scared to death of. Part of the problem with the cover-up and the don't ask, don't tell is all of this is just kept off to the side. You're going to get blindsided. I ask these people to consider how many opportunities they're ever going to have to affect history this way and to consider putting some of that money to good use. That's all I got to say. Maybe we got another question we got.
No specific places to send it, but pick a group.
Contact me. I know of a number of political projects that need money, and I'll be happy to recommend them.
Okay.
They could contact any UFO group, and I'm sure get a half a dozen suggestions.
Oh, I'm sure. All right, good. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. I'm glad I got through tonight.
Where are you?
I'm in North Carolina.
All right.
I'm a college student, and I'm specializing in foreign relations, and I'd like to get into the intelligence field later on. But what I want to ask your guest is, he's been talking about everything that's related to, like, the United States government and everything. Does he have any ideas as far as, like, in the foreign realm, as far as other countries involved, too? Maybe like the UN or not just necessarily the United States and their role as far as, you know, the
UFO. No, actually, that's a very, very good question. It is not just a U.S. question. It is an international question. What about the U.N., Stephen?
Very interesting situation there. Obviously, the number of other countries are very much involved. Britain has a very substantial UFO research community. Italy is moving ahead. Mexico is being brought into this in a very big way.
Oh, yes.
And certainly the Soviet Union.
other countries are clearly involved. And so you might say, gee, why is it that the U.S. seems to dominate? Very interesting point. We are the major power. We did start the nuclear age, in a sense. And we seem we've ended up, as many would have predicted, the top dog. To some degree, for that reason, we seem to be the focus of a lot of this. And also, because of our position as a major power, I think other nations are reluctant to politically step forward and say, look, we've got a lot of evidence here, and we're going to break this open, and we're going to pop the balloon. Because, again, as the young woman pointed out, there's a lot of risk here. And I think some of these countries are thinking, gee, what are the consequences of us forcing this issue ahead of the time schedule that the U.S. mm-hmm. seems to be on? And would they be ignored? I mean, Mexico could call a conference tomorrow and claim that UFOs are here, and it's very good that the rest of the world would just say, hey, that's amusing, and ignore them. And is that right? No, it's not. The rest of the world is kind of a wild card. My hands are pretty full just dealing in the U.S., obviously. But I would not rule out the possibility that something major could come from another country that could force the issue. And that would be interesting.
A real blindsider. That is always a possibility.
Yes, indeed. And they have as much right to get into this full bore as we do.
All right. Every light is lit, Stephen, but the program, she's over.
Okay. Does that mean I get to come back while the lights are lit? What's the protocol?
Well, yeah, that means you get to come back. It also means that you get to go to bed.
Thanks.
Finally, it's getting late back there, or early, I don't know which. At any rate, my friend, I want to thank you for being here. And you might want to listen tomorrow night when we pop the question. That is, if we get the guest.
I'll do my best, but you can count on me archiving it on Real Audio.
All right, my friend.
Alrighty.
Take care. That's it, folks. Sorry, we're out of time. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.